offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is the series where we go through the verses of the Bhagavad Gita. As I've mentioned many times before, the reason for doing that is oftentimes in our quest to explain or understand something which Swami has said before, we tend to turn to the Bhagavad Gita, and it is not surprising, for it's the same Lord, it's the same message, it's the same Vedantic truth, but presented in the context of the times in which it was being delivered. And that makes it relevant through all times, though some of the explanations, some of the examples might be pertaining to that time. We had once done a small episode of Swami's analogies as part of the afternoon satsang. We had in that explained how the same story Swami would sometimes tell by updating it with examples which are more modern and which are understandable for the youth who are sitting there. Similarly, the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedanta, the Upanishads and Swami's discourses have the same essential truth but conveyed with examples, with explanations which are more relevant to the times. So we are going back to the Bhagavad Gita to understand the beautiful verses delivered by Lord Krishna in his discourse to Arjuna, but we are trying to understand it in the context of the modern times, because the message is relevant even today, the message is redeeming even today. This is the 12th episode and we are still in the second chapter, and the second chapter could well be set portrayed as one of the chapters that summarizes the entire Bhagavad Gita. So that makes it also a very cryptic chapter. Every verse is, it contains in it concepts that will later be explained, but it takes a little bit of time to understand some of these things, understanding apart, even to explain and talk about it. So I hope you all bear with me, and that's also the reason why we are going extremely slow, especially in this point. The last week I covered only three verses 13, 14 and 15 of the second chapter, and I'm aware that verse number 15 I did not have enough time to explain. So as I promised last week, we will begin with verse number 15, but nevertheless we heard verses 13, 14, 15 and we kind of made ourselves familiar with the meanings of these verses. In verse number 13, as we saw, Krishna introduces the concept of Dehi, that is the indweller of the body being separate from the body. And it's not that this concept is unknown to Arjuna, because in one way you can see that Arjuna does not react. Arjuna is very well aware of it. In fact, it was a very accepted and understood concept in those times that the Jivatma travels from many bodies and it has this temporary stint in what we call heaven or hell. And then there is the concept of karma, which decides which body the Jivatma enters and all of that. In fact, when I was talking about this, I'd mentioned that there is a discourse in which Swami speaks of three fundamental tenets of Sanatana Dharma, where he mentions this as one of them. In fact, I've got the quote this week, so probably I'll read out that, and you will see this is a very important concept to keep in mind when we are trying to understand where the concepts of Vedanta or explanations of Vedanta come from. Swami says in that particular discourse, and I quote, "The three cardinal principles of the Hindu Dharma are 1. Belief in the series of births. 2. Belief in avatars of the Lords, belief in avatars of the Lord for the re-establishment of Dharma and the transformation of those who have strayed from it. 3 is belief in karma, the fact of every activity having its inevitable consequence and of human destiny being shaped by the cumulative effect of all these consequences." This was a discourse that Swami delivered in Rajamundry way back in 1965, the 1st of April. These are three points that we need to keep in mind, because these are concepts which are very fundamental to the explanations we will be going through, especially what we went through last week, what we will be going through this week, and many more concepts which will be coming. That is that there are multiple births for the same individual. The individual travels from one body to the other, and birth and death is something like a curtain one passes through. That is one important concept. And of course, the concept of karma itself, which is going to be explained very, very elaborately as we go on. Because as I said, there are two dilemmas which Krishna is trying to deal with here. One is death itself, because whatever Arjuna does now is going to result in the death of so many people. So one is he's dealing with the concept of death itself. And the other dilemma which troubles Arjuna is his actions are going to lead to the death of people, which means they are going to become part of his karma. So the second part of the explanation which Krishna will be giving is about karma itself. So the idea of karma and how karma works and how one can cannot give up karma, but how one can practice akarma or non-activity in karma, in action itself. Those are all concepts which Krishna will eventually explain. So as we go through this, and of course the concept of the avatars, the Lord coming down in the form of human birth or other births amidst the other beings of the world to uplift dharma, this is again a concept which Krishna will speak about elaborately. So these three are fundamental to the Sanatan Dharma thought. So we have to keep this in mind. And, you know, this idea of the Dehi and many Dehas is, as I said, not new to Arjuna. And that's why he does not react to this when it's being told to him. And this is not only for the understanding of Bhagavad Gita or Upanishads or Vedanta. I think as Swami's devotees, we have to keep this always in mind. These three points are very, very important to always keep in mind. And the moment you start thinking of you not as this body, but you as the Dehi who is adorning this body and will eventually discard this body and wear another body, when you are firmly established in this belief, all of these concepts that are in the modern day we discuss about, all these dilemmas, the various discussions that we have, be it gender equality or be it about caste, about physical attributes or religion, all of these appear meaningless because today I'm in this body and all of those attributes are attributes of this body. And any moment I'm going to discard this body and I will take another body which will have completely different attributes, a different gender maybe, a different caste, a different color and all of that. So when we are established in this idea that we are the Dehi, and death is nothing but a curtain we pass through before we take up another body, the way we approach many of these modern day concepts and problems and issues will be completely different. So that is one point that we have to keep in mind. Going back to the verses that we were going through last week, Krishna explains that Dehantara Prapti or death is also a change which is very much like the change that occurs from Kaumaram, Yavvanam and Jara, boyhood, youth and old age. And a wise one does not get deluded and recognizes that both these types of changes are similar, right? So that is the explanation of a one who is wise, which Krishna gives Arjuna. These two changes appear different, but fundamentally the change is the same. So one who is wise will be able to see that the change is the same. In the 14th verse, Krishna explains that the experiences of pleasantness and unpleasantness occur due to the interaction that occurs between the senses and the changes that occur outside. Like how one feels when the weather changes, right? When the climate changes. We do not run away every time it becomes too hot or becomes too cold, how unpleasant it becomes. We protect ourselves from it. We protect ourselves from the changes which happen outside and we put up with it, very importantly, with the knowledge that these factors such as heat and cold come and go. Krishna says, similarly, sukha and dukha have to be accepted as agama payina, means that which comes and goes, and anitya or impermanent. And with this idea firmly fixed in the mind, Krishna says, Titikshasva Bharata, tolerate them, O Arjuna. We spoke about this and I also quoted a particular discourse where Swami explains this. In fact, this concept is carried forward to the verse 15 also. But where Swami tells in that discourse, it is not enough if we are able to tolerate it out of weakness or out of inability to do something about it. But you tolerate it with this wisdom that this change which is outside, which is causing this unpleasantness, comes and goes. How many times you've heard Swami say this in his discourses? Pleasure is an interval between two pains. Pain is an interval between two pleasures. And when we remember this, we would never get elated, nor would we get too depressed. So Swami is talking about a wisdom attached to titiksha or tolerance. And it is not mere tolerance that comes out of weakness or dullness, but it is a tolerance which comes out of a higher understanding. And in fact, that concept, as I said, continues in the next verse. We did listen to the verse last time, the 15th verse, but I explained only part of the meaning. The verse goes that yamhina vyathayanti yete purusham purusharashabha samadukka sukham dhiram somritatvaya kalpate. So when we talk about this idea of being constant, whether it is pleasure or happiness or cold or hot, we were left with this question: what happens once a person attains that kind of equanimity? And that answer is in the 15th verse, where Krishna says, sama dukkha sukham dhiram somritatvaya kalpate. The one who is stable in pleasure and pain, dhiram is the word which he uses. Dhiram means one who is stable and strong, but dhiram also suggests that it is a stability that comes out of wisdom. That is what I had explained last time. Somritatvaya kalpate. Such a person is fit for gaining liberation. That's what Krishna says. Somritatvaya kalpate. He becomes fit to be conferred liberation upon. But before we move on to the next shloka and the shloka which we have for today, the one part which I wanted to talk about in this verse number 15 is the word which Krishna uses, vyathayanti, right? Krishna says, na vyathayanti, the wise don't get disturbed. Physically, is it possible not to feel cold when it's cold? Not to sweat and feel warm when it's summer? I think that's not possible. The physical change or the physical reaction does occur unless we are talking about a yogic state where that person achieves that kind of a siddhi where one can completely get detached from the conditions outside. But, you know, a person who is a normal person, however wise that person may be, however intelligent and however spiritually wise that person may be, the body will undergo changes based on the changes that happen outside. Right, there will be sweating when it's too hot, and there will be shivering when it becomes unbearably cold. But here the word which Krishna uses, vyathayanti, means to disturb or to unsettle. It suggests that it's not wrong to react to these changes outside as one has to, because that's what Swami told in that discourse. When it becomes too cold, you wear an extra line of clothing. When it becomes too warm, you wear clothes which are loose-fitting and which make you feel more comfortable. There's nothing wrong in that. It is right to be practical in that sense. But Swami says in this particular point that you observe yourself when you are worrying. What we do is, much before the problem comes, we start getting disturbed about it. And much after it has gone by, we keep thinking about it. In other words, it is we who extend the suffering. The moment our minds get involved in a reaction like that, the summer is coming, and 1 month before the summer comes, we are already thinking about how severe the summer is going to be and how much I'm going to suffer the summer, which means I have already started getting disturbed even before the change has come to me. Right? And that is what this vyathayanti means, that disturbance. When you drop a pebble in a placid lake, the ripples go on for a long time even after the pebble has sunk into the water, right? So that ripple which it has caused lasts for much longer than that impact the pebble has with the surface of water. And very similar to that, when we are disturbed, that state of being disturbed lasts for much longer than that physical unpleasantness which we have interacted with. And that's why Swami would very, very beautifully say in one particular discourse, Swami says this in English, and it's wonderful the way Swami puts it across. He says, what is the shape of worry? It is all mentally created fear only. That's what Swami says. It is a mentally created fear. It's a concept that the mind creates. Yes, there is unpleasantness when there is change outside. That's what Krishna is telling Arjuna. Some changes will be unpleasant, but the unpleasantness that it, the disturbance that it causes in the mind, that is the problem. If it's just the unpleasantness that the body feels or the mind feels or the senses detect, it should go away with that. But the mind gets disturbed. I read this short story sometime back, a small humorous story, but very beautifully it kind of humorously captures this concept which Arjuna is being told here. I think this was a time when the Russian border was being made. So I think after the war, Russia was redrawing its borders, and it came to the point where they were drawing the border between Finland and Russia. So the option to join either of the countries were given to some of the owners of large farms. So there was this farm owner on the border of these two countries who had this huge farm, and he was given this opportunity to choose where he wants to be. So finally he chooses to be on the side of Finland, and the borders are drawn, and eventually one day the Russian officers walk up to him and they ask him, why have you not chosen to be with Russia? Why did you choose Finland over us? Right, and this is a very old gentleman. He looks at him and he says, you know what, from my childhood, I always wanted to be a part of Mother Russia. I always had a fascination for Russia. I thought I will be a citizen of Mother Russia. But you know, my age is so advanced now, I don't think I will be able to handle Russian winters anymore. Right, that is the reply he gives to the people. I don't think I'll be able to handle Russian winters anymore. And if you have read literature, especially literature by people like Tolstoy and other Russian writers, you will remember there will always be that description of Russian winters, the Siberian winters, very, very harsh winters. But imagine if you are in the border of Finland and Russia, this concept of a Russian winter is only in our mind. The winter is winter. It's going to be as severe as it is whether you're in this side of the border or that side of the border. I mean, this is a funny story. This is an absurd story, you might think of it as. But we do precisely this in our life. We give shape to that worry, as Swami says. It does not have a worry, it does not have a shape of its own. It does not have a presence of its own. But when we indulge our mind in that and let the mind get disturbed, that's when we actually give shape to that. Right? A winter is winter. We make it a Russian winter. We make a summer, Indian summer. The summer has no boundaries, right? Similarly, a problem, a worry, a happy occurrence does not have any border, does not have any special liking towards you and me or special hatred towards you and me. It comes and goes, it comes and goes on its own, right? So it is we who give that kind of an importance to it and make it worry us more. So this is one thing which Krishna says here. He says a wise person will not let all of these things disturb him so much. There's another beautiful Zen story I'd read a long time ago where one disciple goes to the Zen master and he says, what is the best way to lead life? You know, I've earned a lot of money and I do a lot of things. I travel a lot. But tell me, according to Zen philosophy, what is the best way to lead life? And the Zen master tells him, when there is pain, cry. When there is joy, laugh. That's all there is to do. And this man says that, but that's precisely how all of us lead our lives, right? But the Zen master says, no, that is all is the Zen way. When there is pain, you cry. When there is joy, you laugh and you smile. The deeper meaning of that story is precisely what I just told you. That if we even master the art of just being unhappy only for that brief moment when unhappiness is meant to be, then I think we will be much, much more happy than otherwise, right? It is because we carry that unpleasantness, we carry that state of being disturbed for much longer than it calls for. That's why we are disturbed, and that's what Krishna is saying here. The one who is wise will know that pleasure and pain comes and goes, so he does not get attached to one, he does not get repulsed by one. He just stays, he just sees them coming and go, coming and going. Agama, payina, that's what is their nature. And he does not get disturbed. Na vyathayanti. Na vyathayanti yete purusham. That person who does not get disturbed by both of these, he is a dhiram, and such a dhiram is somratattvaya kalpate. Makes himself or herself worthy of being granted liberation. So that's verse number 15. We'll go to verse number 16. This is again a very, very critical and very important verse. We'll first listen to it. It's in the voice of Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, but I think there's much to be discussed about this particular verse. We'll talk about that after we listen to the verse itself.
Na sato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha, ubhayorapi drishtontaha, tvanayostatva darshibihi.
That which is not shall never be. That which is shall never cease to be. The truth about both has been seen by the knowers of the essence or the knowers of tattva. This is a very, very important shloka. This is a very important shloka by itself. Standalone, it's a very important shloka. And of course, as part of what Krishna is explaining, the previous shlokas and the shlokas that are to be followed, even in the context, this is also a very important shloka. Standalone, the shloka introduces some very important Vedantic concepts, and it does so very, very cryptically. We'll speak about that first, and then we'll come to the context of the shloka. The concepts of sat and asat, bhava and abhava, tattva and tattva darshana, these are the most important concepts which are being very briefly touched upon in this particular shloka, and these are very fundamental concepts, especially when you're talking about the Upanishads and Vedanta and all of that. What is Sat? We'll start with that. The first couple which is being spoken of here is Sat and Asat. So what is this Sat? The simple definition of that is Sat means the truth or that which is real. And that means asat is the antonym of that. So asat is that which is not true or that which is unreal. In Vedanta, there is always this idea of explaining any of these concepts based on something that we already know, already understand in day-to-day life. Just like how Krishna did. He talks about the feeling of cold and hot and how he explains that with death and life, right? Similarly, that's precisely how Vedanta always explains concepts. So when you talk about Sat and Asat, let's see if we can understand it in the same manner. Let's take something which we know in our day-to-day life and try to extrapolate it to understand what Vedanta refers to as Sat or the ultimate truth. So what is truth in our day-to-day understanding? Let's take, for example, that there is a market scene, right? It's a busy market and a lot of people are there going about their work. And let's say that there's a mischievous kid there who decides to play some mischief, and he sets off a firecracker right in the middle of the market, right? So this is the scene. It's a busy market. A kid has come and sets off firecrackers. So if I were to describe this scene, I just did that, right? So what I say, if I exactly tell you what happened, that is the truth, right? That's the simple understanding that we have. If I were to tell you what did not happen, then it becomes untruth, right? So what happened is the truth. a description of what did not happen becomes the untruth. That which is, or that which happened, is true. That which is not, or which did not happen, or does not exist, is not true. As simple as that. And that's the simple definition given in this particular shloka. Na asato vidyate bhavo. Asat or untruth, na vidyate, does not have bhava, an existence or beingness. Na abhavo vidyate sataha. And sat or the truth, na vidyate, does not have abhava, non-existence or non-being. And that's how the other couple gets introduced here, bhava and abhava. It's very difficult to give a simple definition of bhava and abhava other than just saying that it is beingness or isness. So what is truth, what is not is untruth, as simple as that. But we are still talking about spoken truth, right? So when I describe a scene, for it to be true, it must have happened. Just like that market scene that I described. For what I say to be true, that what I say should have happened. If it did not happen, then it is not true. So truth and beingness, or truth and existence, are connected in that manner. So the example which I've given so far is the example of spoken truth. The verbal description I give of something is true if what I say really happened. That's what we have established so far. But from this concept, I just take the essence, which is truth is beingness. The truth is that state of existence, right? And that's what Krishna tells in this particular verse. He says, in the second part of the first line, he says that, na abhavo vidyate sataha. Sataha, the truth, does not have non-existence, which is the other way of saying that truth always has existence and untruth does not have existence. Now, when we speak of reality as a nature of an object, till now we only spoke about spoken truth. Now, when we talk about truth or reality as a nature of an object, let's say I take an object and through my actions I can stop its existence, then that object is not real in the ultimate sense. Because for something to be true, it needs to exist. Existence and truth are two qualities which cannot be separated. So it did have a brief existence, right? We'll come back to that. What about those things which have a brief existence? As long as they exist, right? Even if I'm able to destroy it or stop its existence, we'll come back to that. But if an object, its existence can be put to an end through any action that I do, then that object is not true, because we have established that truth is beingness. When I tell you a lie about what I see, if I've seen a scene and I tell you a lie, that description is real only till you find out from others that what I've told you is a lie, right? I give you a description of a scene which is untrue, and in your mind it is true because you're hearing it from me. Probably you trust my words. Probably you have faith in my honesty, so you trust my words. But the moment you hear from others what exactly happened, when you hear that what I've told is untrue, immediately the scene vanishes from your mind. You will not hold on to that. When there is doubt, it's a different thing. But if you're convinced, or somebody shows you a video of the scene as it happened, immediately the truth changes in your mind. So what I've told ceases to be the truth, right? So that which vanishes or ceases to exist on an investigation is asat or unreal. I see a mirage on the road. It appears real to me, but when I go close, it vanishes, which means on investigation, it disappears. So we conclude that mirage is unreal. Now we'll consider the shloka after having understood this till this much, the shloka in the context of the previous shlokas, before we go back and speak about the concepts of sat and asat from the Vedantic standpoint, because it's important. This is a very, very important concept, and I am trying to go slow because as I always tell you, I'm also trying to understand as much as possible, even as I'm telling it to you. Krishna spoke about cold and heat, sorrow and happiness. And in the previous shloka, just before this one, we spoke about getting disturbed, vyatayati, which is a mental state. Heat and cold, pleasure and pain are all relative if we were to examine it. And if we truly investigate and examine deeply, they actually go away. So with what do we examine something like heat and cold or dukkha and sukha? Let's say I take a gold ornament and give it to a goldsmith. The goldsmith investigates it. How does he investigate it? He rubs it against a metal surface or a rough surface, and that's how he examines it, and he'll tell you that this is pure gold or true gold or fake gold, right? Similarly, we have to examine an experience with reference to time, with reference to the experience which others are having, right? If I tell you that this is the description of the scene I saw, you ask others if everybody has seen that. We'll come back to that. That's again a very important concept. So we investigate whether something is true based on, first of all, the reference of time, and secondly, the reference of others' experiences. And that is how we realize that these experiences are not absolute, but it is we who give them a certain life. Just like how I told you that it is our mental, the way we react to it mentally is what gives them their real life in that sense. Let us say I start a business today and I make my first $1 million. You can imagine how happy one will be when they've had a startup and they've made that first million. If you don't know, you have to go and just listen to some of the businessmen who've started small and made it big. What went through their mind and the joy that they experienced when they made that first million, maybe producing that first million products or making that first $1 million. So imagine I've started my business and I made my first $1 million. You can imagine the state of happiness that I will be. On the other hand, imagine the richest person in the world, or let's take Mr. Bill Gates, who's supposed to be one of the most richest people in the world even today. And it is said that he makes more than $1 million every hour. Will he be as happy when he makes $1 million? He makes it every hour. Does it mean that for every hour he's going to be as happy as I will feel when I make my first million? So doesn't that itself suggest that this happiness that one feels is relative? It is not absolute. Because if it is absolute, like suppose I take a pen, I give you one pen, you have one pen, and I keep giving you one pen after one pen. At the end of 10 pens, the space that it occupies in your bag or in your hand is 10 times that one pen, right? That's an absolute existence in that sense. But happiness is not like that. The happiness that one feels when one makes $1 million doesn't seem to be getting multiplied in that manner, which means the happiness that one feels is actually very, very relative in that sense. Similarly, you know, let's say that in my business I lose $1 million. If that happens to anybody with a small business, they're going to be devastated. They're going to be never going to get up from that shock. But imagine Bill Gates makes $30 million every day. On one particular day, he makes $29 million, let's say. Is he going to be as devastated as I am? No, he's not going to be, because this feeling of pain also is so relative, right? Relative to so many things, relative to my condition, relative to what I'm thinking, relative to how much importance I'm giving to money. All of these put together makes that happiness and pain give it a shape, right? So they do not have an absolute existence in that sense. So pleasantness and unpleasantness, sukha and dukkha, cold and heat, all these do not stand the test of scrutiny of time and the test of perspective or others' experiences. So how can they be true or absolute? And what is untrue cannot make us unhappy. What is untrue cannot make us unhappy. Suppose I come and tell you that, oh, you know, there's been a bomb last year or so-and-so has passed away. If I'm telling you a lie, the moment I moment you recognize that what I've told you is a lie, will you continue to feel bad about it? Because what is untrue should not make us unhappy. What is untrue should not make us happy also, right? If I come and tell you that, oh, you won $1 million in lottery, the moment you realize that what I'm telling you is a lie, your happiness vanishes, right? So you cannot be unhappy with an untruth. And even as I was going through this, I was reminded of a very small incident which happened in Swami's presence. It was a very light-hearted incident, but it reminded me of this, how you cannot be unhappy when you recognize something to be untrue. It happened after Swami got back from the Kodai trip in 1999, and there were, I think, a few boys, maybe 20 odd boys whom Swami had taken along for that Kodai trip. So Swami had got back, and these boys were staying in the hostel, and one day Swami called one of these boys, a senior of mine, and Swami told him, okay, you tell all of those boys who came to Kodai with me to be ready. I'm going to take them to the house of a devotee by name Mr. Balram, who's passed away now, a person who used to drive Swami's car when Swami was in Vrindavan. So that particular devotee had invited Swami with all these boys to his house for lunch. So Swami told this particular boy that go and tell all the others to be ready. I'm going to take them out maybe around 11 in the morning, right? So this was what Swami told. And Swami told that boy that, you know, Balram has called us for lunch and all that, and so I'm going to take all of you. So this boy promptly went to the hostel and told all of his friends, seniors and juniors who were there, that this is what Swami has told, all of you be ready, that we have to go to Balram's house. So 11 o'clock, all of you be ready to get into the bus, right? So Swami went for Swami's darshan and went for interviews. At the end of interview, Swami comes out and all of these boys are ready there. They were, you know, well groomed and they are ready to get into the bus. And Swami comes and, Swami pretends as though he's surprised to see all of them standing there. So he comes and says, hey, andar vachar enti, what all of you have come. So all of them gather around Swami. And then one of the boys said, Swami, we have come because Swami is taking us out to Balram's house for lunch, Mr. Balram's house for lunch. And immediately Swami looked at this boy through whom Swami had sent word, and Swami said, did I tell you to tell them that I'm taking them for lunch? I only told you that ask those boys to be ready and come and stand here. And this boy started sweating. And Swami was very, very serious. Swami was very upset. And he said, see, this is what you boys do. You never listen to what Swami is telling. I only told you, just ask them to come here. Why did you have to go and tell them that, you know, Balram has called us for lunch and all of that? And this boy was like, Swami, really sorry, Swami, really sorry, Swami, I did not mean to do that. And Swami said, no, it was very bad. Now see what has happened. Now Balram tells me that there are guests coming to his house. So he has come and told me, Swami, don't come today for lunch, you come later. Right? So this is what Swami is telling. And you can imagine there's no devotee who's going to come and tell that to Swami. That Swami, I have guests at home, so please don't come today. But this is Swami's, you know, he was just wanting to bully the boys. So Swami said, see, this is what happened. And Mr. Balram was just around. And Swami called him, Balram, bolo, boys ko bolo kya hua? Swami tells him, and Mr. Balram also plays along, and he says, Swami, aaj guest aata hai, and all that he said. And Swami looked at the boys and says, see what has happened now? The program has got cancelled. And Swami looks at this boy and says, see, because of you, I'm getting a bad name now. So all the boys were very sad, and, everybody in the group kind of had a hint that Swami is probably pulling their leg and Swami is just playing along. But, they were all like telling, sorry, Swami, please, Swami, forgive us, Swami, don't be upset with us and all of that. And Swami carried on this drama for a few minutes, and suddenly Swami said, Poni, akada basundi, andaru ready ga aipoyin tarvata, akada poi kurchondi, Swami. He said, okay, everything is over, suggesting that, okay, I was just playing along with you. The bus is there behind Thrai Vrindavan. All of you just go in a line and go and get into the bus. I'll come. But this particular instruction that Swami was giving, Swami gave it in Telugu, right? And Swami was giving this entire explanation. There was this one boy who understood absolutely nothing of what Swami told in Telugu. He only understood that Swami is upset, and that first part he understood because it happened in Hindi and English mix. But what this explanation that Swami gave, saying that the drama is over now, go and get into the bus, he did not hear one word of that, or he did not understand one word of that, because he was a Nepali boy, right? So as Swami was giving all these instructions, suddenly this boy gets up and he tells, Swami, please forgive us, Swami, please take us also along, Swami, he said. And Swami looked at this boy and Swami looked at the others and said, Videntra, Anni Aipoin Tarvata Ibdu please Antunadu. Meaning that even after understanding that what I've told is just for fun, it is not true, this fellow is still, you know, keeping a long face and crying. It's a very small and very loving incident where Swami was just playing along with students and, you know, this boy was finally became the laughing stock. And finally Swami had to explain to him in Hindi that, you know, it was a drama, everything is over now, you're absolutely speaking out of context. But imagine, that's what Swami was saying, that the moment you know that something which was told was untrue, it is absolutely meaningless to continue with the sorrow. It makes no sense to continue with the sorrow once you know that something which is told to you is untrue, right? It's simple logic. And that's precisely what Swami is telling. I have told that I've been bullying all this while. It's just a joke, that prank that I was playing. Why is he continuing to be unhappy and why is he pleading with me still, right? So this is the crux of what Krishna is saying. What is untrue should not make you happy, should not make you unhappy. That's precisely what Krishna tells Arjuna right in the beginning. What does he say? He says, Ashochyan anvashochastvam prajna vadansya bhashase. He says, what should not be grieved for? Ashochyan, that which is not to be grieved about, anvashochastvam, you are grieving for that. And what is Ashochyan, or what is that which should not be grieved for? Asat is Ashochyan. Asat or untruth is that which should not be worried about. Because once you know that somebody is telling you untruth, where is the question of worrying about it? Like somebody comes in here, tells you that, oh, you know, so-and-so passed away, and you start crying. And then another person comes and says, no, he is just, he didn't know what he told was not true. And imagine you continue crying because you've heard it once. The moment you know that what was told to you is untrue, the grief stops. Same with pleasure too. So that is what Krishna is saying here. So in the context of this discussion, Krishna is telling the Dehi is constant. Death only puts an end to the body, and that makes the body untrue, right? Because truth and existence are completely related to each other. And anything that can put an end to an object suggests that the object itself is untrue. So he says, death only puts an end to the body, which makes the body untrue, and the body is unreal or asat. So the death which happens to the body also has to be asat. And you are crying over something which is untrue. Just like how it is meaningless to cry over a false statement, it is meaningless to cry over death which is asat. So what is worthy of worrying about, or what is sochyan, or what is worthy of grief? Nothing actually. Why will we cry over truth? Why will we cry over something which never comes or never goes? Right? Krishna is saying, why cry over death? Because it's asat. The corollary of that is, it would be even more weird to cry over something which is sat, which is truth, which never comes and goes. Imagine I'm sitting in the corner and I'm crying. A friend comes and says, hey, what happened? Why are you crying? I'm crying because you're alive. That will be like the biggest joke I can crack. It's silly to cry over something which is untrue. It is sillier to cry over something which is true. But that will come later. But at this point, he says that death is untrue because the body itself is untrue, and to cry over it is absurdity. Now we'll go back to this shloka where it speaks about sat and asat, and we'll spend a little more time in this, because it's a very important concept, as I mentioned, in the Upanishads and in Vedanta itself. Let's go back also to the marketplace where I told you that there is this small child which bursts the crackers, and let's say somebody sets off a rumor that there was a bomb blast in the marketplace, right? And what, that rumor spreads like wildfire, and eventually the press reporters are there and the police are there. Now, if the police want to find out what is actually the truth, what will they do? They will ask all the others there. The eyewitnesses will be asked as to what happened. The moment everybody says that, no, actually what happened was just this mischievous child set off this cracker, the truth is established, right? So what is the meaning of that? When we say that an event has happened, why do we go around asking everybody there as to what they saw, because the truth is not subjective. The truth is common to everybody who sees it. All people present in that particular place should have seen the same incident, and only then that description becomes truth. So truth does not change with the observer. It is independent of the observer, which means it is non-subjective. Similarly, what is true should not change with the conditions too. You know, when we were children, let's say we would go and stay in our aunt's place or in somebody else's place, I think all of us would have had this experience. Suddenly we'll look out of the window and it'll appear like there's somebody standing there, and there's a gloomy figure standing and peering into the window. And we would be really scared. We would just pull the blanket over our head and sleep. And the next morning we will be lying on the same bed maybe, and when we see, it would be something like a bush or a tree or a branch of a tree or a part of the building which appeared like somebody was standing there, right? I think many of us have had this experience. So which means the same object does not remain the same in different conditions. In other words, we look for some conditions which are more reliable to ascertain what that truth is, right? So the same observer sees two different versions, which means that each one of those versions need not necessarily be true. We look for what is more reliable to ensure what that truth is, right? So what is truth from this understanding that we have had? We associate two qualities with it. One is it is non-subjective, which means it is independent of the observer, and it is also independent of the conditions under which it is observed, right? In fact, in science, especially when you're doing scientific research or when you're trying to measure some particular entity, we talk of these two concepts, and most of you who have done a little bit of research in science, studied science, will know this. We call it repeatability and reproducibility. For any scientific experiment to be considered as true, it needs to be repeatable and reproducible. Of course, there are clauses and conditions depending on what that experiment is. I'm not going into all of that. But this idea of repeatability and reproducibility is important for the understanding we are trying to gain right now. When I do some experiment or measurement, when I do it on a different day, I have measured it today and I've got a certain result, let's say, or I've done this experiment, I've got a certain result. If I were to come again 2 or 3 days later and do the same experiment following the same procedure, I should get the same results. And this is what we refer to as repeatability. I should be able to repeat the same experiment and get the same results. The other is the same experiment, the same procedures, the same steps. If somebody else does it in some random place or some other lab or somewhere across the globe, when they do it, they should get results which are very similar, or which, you know, again, it goes into statistics as to how much deviation from your results can there be and can be acceptable and all of that. But this idea of reproducibility, what I have created or what I have measured or what I have, the result I've ended up with, if somebody were to repeat the same experiment with the same procedure and the same steps, he or she should be able to get the same results. And that is what we call reproducibility. These two are very important because that is how we define truth. Truth is not subjective to the observer, and truth is not subjective to the conditions under which it was being observed. So in our day-to-day life, the truth is truth no matter who observes it, and it is the same under different conditions, as simply put as that. So when I say different conditions, it means when I see a bush at night and you see the same bush at night, it should be the same experience, right? I'm not... I gave you that example. You might say that when you see it at night, it's different. When you see it in the morning, it's different. I'm talking about repeated reproducibility in that sense. If you were to see lying on the same bed and looking through the same window, it might appear the same way to you, right? So the same bush you see in the morning is different. So basically, it is concurrence of observance what we are talking about. The other quality of sat or truth is, it does not undergo modification with time. As I told you in that, before we spoke about the context of the shloka, one of the ways by which we analyze something to be true or false is by investigating through reference of time, right? So the quality of truth, one of the important qualities of truth is that it does not undergo modification with time. That which does not undergo modification with time is considered more true. Now, this is again a very, very important point, and it is something which we understand in our day-to-day experience too. Let's say if you go around and ask somebody, now who is this Prem from Radio Sai? And somebody gives this description, oh, that Prem is the person who sits in front of the mic and who has this script in front of him and who speaks about the Gita. Now, this is a fact, but it is not a truth. Because this description will fit me only for probably the next 15-20 minutes, not more than that. Right? It is true, but it is true for a very brief time, so it is not the ultimate truth. So if you want to know who truly this Prem from Radio Sai is, probably somebody will give you a better description and say that, oh no, he has this kind of hair and he has this sort of a height and, you know, he has a clean shaven face and he has this and he has that. Some descriptions which could probably be considered more permanent, right? So that would be a little more truer description of me. But again, that cannot be taken as absolute truth. Because who knows, tomorrow I might come with a long beard, tomorrow I might come with a long hair. So that description ceases to relate to me, but I still continue to be that person Prem from Radio Sai, right? That definition does not suit me, but my reality still continues. And that is why, you know, when we were in school, when we were to get admitted in school, what would they ask us? They will tell, do you have any birthmarks? Because birthmark is something which is considered more permanent. They will not ask you, they will not measure your hair, or they will not say how tall you are, because all of these things undergo a change. And as Krishna said, these changes are considered as natural, but your dehi is more real. So even in the body, they look for something which is more permanent. They ask for birthmarks, which maybe will not go away with time. Right? Most of the birthmarks are like that. It will not go away with time or get lost in your changes the skin undergoes. But now what do? If you want identification for a person, you know, we have all these kind of unique identity cards. In India, we have what is called the Aadhaar card. What would they do? They will take your fingerprint or they will take your retina scans. There are two things to it. One is it's a unique identity to you, but it is an identity which is more long-lasting, which is more permanent, which is, because it is more permanent, it is more true. So even in our regular understanding as we go through life, we have this idea that something to be more true should be more permanent, right? Something to be more dependably true, it needs to stand the test of time, right? So we believe truth is comparatively more permanent, right? My clothes are not me. The color of my hair changes, but I am still me. I may become thin, I may become fat, but I am still me. I may even lose a limb, but I am still me. So the real me is not this body that changes with kaumaram, yavanam, manjara, boyhood, youth and old age. Not even that which changes with dehantara prapti, or when it gets another body through the process we refer to as death. So it suggests that what is true in me is something which is much, much more deeper. So going back to truth or sat. So truth by definition, even in our regular usage, also is something that is one, not subjective to one observer, not conditional to circumstances, and that which is relatively more permanent. So when we speak of the ultimate truth, when Krishna is referring to sat and asat, the sat that he is referring to is the ultimate truth. So if we were to take these as the qualities of truth, and now when we want to define what is ultimate truth, it must have all these qualities in absoluteness. Which means truth when seen by whomsoever is undeniably true. It does not undergo any modification with time or conditions or circumstances, and truth is eternal, right? There's a philosopher, I think I must have quoted his words many times before, he would often say this, what I tell you is not the truth. Imagine a philosopher who wants to be heard and who wants his words to be given importance to is saying this, whatever I tell you in my discourses, whatever I tell you in my satsangs is not true. And he would say this is the explanation he would give, because if I were to tell you the truth, first of all, the truth can never be spoken. The truth can never be described in words. But if I manage to do that, if I tell you the truth or if I show you the truth in front of you, there is no way you can deny it. The very fact that we are debating, we are trying to understand, means that what I am saying is not the truth. It is only a pointer to the truth. And Swami would often say this, if you ask somebody, where is the moon? They will tell you that, you know, the moon is just behind the branch that you see there, or just between the tree and that particular building. These are all references. The moon is actually nowhere behind the tree or between the building and the tree. These are pointers to the truth, right? Similarly, whatever we speak, whatever I'm telling you in as part of the show or any show, these are all nothing but what we refer to as pointers to truth. When we come face to face with truth, it is undeniable. Nobody will be able to stand up and deny it. And that's why truth and silence always goes together, right? So truth is something which does not undergo modification, and that which is absolute, anybody who comes face to face with it will have to accept it, right? So for everything that undergoes modification, Vedanta believes that there must be an underlying permanence. This is the other derivation which comes from the idea that Sat is that which is unchanging. So if there is something which is changing, there must be something which is unchanging, which is the basis for this. Just like I am the same body, but the body undergoes change. The same mud is made into a pot. Tomorrow the pot breaks and returns to mud. The mud is the basis. The pot is the changing. The pot is the asat. The mud is the sat. So also, all that is changing is asat, but it must have a basis which is sat, or that which is more permanent. And that is why Vedanta says that if we were to go behind each of these objects that we see and interact with, be it an individual or be it an object, if we start going deeper and deeper into each one of it, it says that there must be one true permanent entity which forms all of these things. This again is a very important concept, because Krishna continues from this concept in the next verse, which we'll have to wait till the next week. But this is what he says. And this is referred to in Vedanta as Sat Vastu. Simply put, the most direct translation of that is a true thing, right? That's the only description you can give it. Sat Vastu. So there must be a Sat Vastu behind all of these Asat. And that is referred to as Brahman or divine, right? But then the question comes, why do we see the world and ourselves and it does feel very, very real, right? It does feel real when you see a person in front of you, that person appears real. I am real. I don't ever get up and feel that I am unreal, right? That needs to be drilled into my head through satsang and through Swami's discourses. But the real understanding when I wake up is I am a real person, right? You never feel that I am unreal. So why is that experience there? One reason could be that our reference of time is very, very minuscule. When you say this entire creation is asat, right? That is again one of the assertions of Vedanta. It says this entire jagat is untrue, right? When you say that, why is it that it never occurs to us? Yes, it is also undergoing change. Yes, it also has a beginning and end, this creation. But our existence in this creation is so minuscule in this particular body and in this particular mind that it never appears to us as obvious that this creation can be untrue. So all this Krishna is telling Arjuna to tell him, that a true jnani or pandita will know all of these, what I've explained. And in this verse, he says in the second line, a real jnani will know that the nature of sat and asat and the difference between the two. The one who knows this and recognizes is only a jnani. In other words, they will not confuse sat with asat. When I say cut my nails or go for a haircut, I will not shed tears over these parts of my body which were there with me till yesterday being discarded away, right? Because I am wise enough to know that these are parts of the body that come and go. So Krishna is telling, when you are wise enough to know that the Dehi is the real person, why will you cry over your death or for that matter, anyone's death. In this shloka, Krishna uses the name Tattvadarshinaha. For the wise ones, he uses the phrase Tattvadarshinaha, again a very, very beautiful word. What is the meaning of this appellation? Those who have seen or recognized the Tattva. What is this Tattva? This is a word we have heard so many times in Swami's discourses. We read this in so much literature. What do we mean by this word Tattva? The word Tattva is derived from the word Tat. Tat is a pronoun, right? Just like how we say that, right? And there are a lot of linguists who believe that the word that has come from this word Tat. But we'll not go into that debate. Tat is a pronoun. What is the concept of pronoun in language? You know, in regular English literature, I mean English language or English grammar, what do we mean by a pronoun? A pronoun is a noun that can be used for anyone, which means the name and form of that entity does not matter. There's a tumbler in front of me. When I say tumbler, it means a specific thing. But when I say this, pointing to it, when I say this, when you're listening only this word this, you will not think of a tumbler, isn't it? But I can use the word for the tumbler too. I can point out to the bottle in front of me and say this, right? And that is what a pronoun does. A pronoun is something which can be used for any entity. In other words, it negates name and form and any such characteristic. So tat is a pronoun which negates name and form. So the reality that exists after a name and form of an entity and all that changes about it is removed is what we refer to as the tat in that particular entity. And tattva is that most, I mean, if I were to put it very, very crassly, the thatness of an object, that is what is tattva. And that is nothing but that tat is sat. That is the other understanding which Krishna will drive in through the verses we are going to go. So tattva is a person, a tattva darshana is a person who when he sees an object or when he sees a scenario, he does not go by the names and forms and all that which changes, but he sees that the same tat which is there in that entity is the same tat which pervades everything. Right? So a tattva darshana is one who can see the reality beyond the changing unreal nature of objects. And it is the truth that once you see, you can never unsee it. Just like how an optical illusion. Till you see the optical illusion or till you see that one particular thing which makes this appear like moving or something. But once you see how that illusion works, you will never unsee it. Right? That's what they say. And similarly, once you become a tattva-darshina, once you see the truth, once you see the tattva of everything that is changing, you will never unsee it, right? And that's what Krishna is saying here, that once a person becomes a jnani, a tattva-darshina, he will never get confused between what is sat and what is asat, what is real and what is unreal. So Lord Krishna has shown that what is sat, self-existent, independent, does not have abhava at any time, right? Sat is self-existent, which means it does not have anything which is the basis of it. It is the basis of everything. It does not have something which is the basis of it. It is self-evident, self-existent. It is independent. And at no point it has abhava or non-existence. It is always existent, meaning that there is no end or non-existent to it. Sataha abhavaha na vidyate. And asat being only a name and form, depending upon that sat or reality, has no real bhava or real being. And therefore, it is what we refer to as mithya. Or another word for this mithya is what Swami very beautifully explains in one of his vahinis. It is called sat asat. I'll probably leave it here. We will talk about sat asat next week and from there we'll take on the next verses. I know this is a ridiculously slow pace to take only one shloka on a particular week. But as I was going through that explanation, you would have understood that this is not a very simple concept to explain and understand. So I hope you will bear with my speed. As we go through these verses, I think we will be able to pick up pace here and there. But for now, I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I hope what I said made sense. And if there's any explanation that you would want me to give you further, you can always write to me. I'd be happy to do that. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of this Triune Pilgrimage, the Gita series.